Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And on Friday, we talked about one of the biggest events of the year 1981, the Air Traffic Controllers Union strike. President Ronald Reagan ordered everyone back to work within 48 hours or be fired. And in fact, for those of you who didn't live through that or hear a Friday show, he ended up firing 11,000 federal workers, banning them for life. The poet, Gregory Pardlow, whose father was an air traffic controller at the time, talked to us about what that moment in time felt like.
The reaction was so wildly diametric, right? And so both sides were really heated and passionate about their positions, and it didn't seem like much conversation was happening at all.
Gregory Pardlow, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, on this show on Friday, talking about his memoir of him and his father, Air Traffic. Sound familiar? Well, looking back, it looks like the early Reagan years of the early 80s may have had a lasting impact not just on national politics, but on New York City culture. And for this week's issue of T, the New York Times Style magazine, they make the case that New York City from 1981 to 83 represents a turning point in art, music, theater, film, fashion, and food. And joining me now to reflect on those 36 short months is Hanya Yanagihara, writer and editor of T, New York Times Style magazine. Hi, Hanya. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you take us back to what New York City was like just before this period the T magazine has isolated, and some of the, what set up the stuff you wrote about?
You know, I think that there are some moments before a city, I call them hinge moments, and they're moments in which sort of one era draws to the close, whether it's a great or an awful moment, and the next era begins. And it's in those liminal periods that something comes in to fill the void. And in the months and the years directly before 1981, it really was a very dark hinge moment for the city. You know, it was broke. This was right after the infamous blackout and the garbage strikes, right before the garbage strikes. And it was right before a new president. It was at the end of the 70s, which, you know, was a fascinating time in New York and one that tends to get a lot of credit for the birth of punk rock and so on. But it was also a very, a dark and shape-shifting time. No one really knew what New York was going to become. And it was into this void that the artists and creative people who have always been drawn to this city made the city into something completely new.
And what's your overarching thesis about what changed? How much was it about the polarized early Reagan era? We forget how much, in a certain respect, it was like these early days of Trump.
Yes,
people
exactly.
Thought he was going to get us into a nuclear war, that
yes.
He was so right-wing, that he was the biggest, you know, racist and sexist on the planet and everything else. Much of the country was veering to the right with him.
Yes.
But here, New York City was still being New York City.
Yes. Well, you know, New York has always been sort of isolated unto itself. But I think the last period that you had such a culturally fecund time in New York was probably in the 50s, when you had the abstract expressionists, when you had the beat poets. But I think the big difference is that politics wasn't aligned as it was during the early Reagan years with the Christian far right. There wasn't that sort of union, and it was the first period in which you had conservatism in the White House and also the beginning of what would become a mass media culture, that you had a dissolution of a single cultural authority, and you had people who, and you had the plague, you had AIDS, although it wasn't even named until 1983. So all of those factors came together to create this combustible moment. And, you know, art, as we think about in this magazine, is always at its richest and its most urgent when it has something to fight against. And so if any one of those factors had been missing, if the money coming in from the Reagan administration had been missing, if his alliance with the Christian far right had been missing, if AIDS had been missing, you might not have had the sort of swirl and the sort of torment and the sort of energy that you had in those months.
And so you treat the AIDS epidemic in various ways. The writer Edmund White writes about the early 80s, about being told by a doctor in 81 to basically stop having sex because
right.
He's a gay man. He writes, we still had wounds from the 60s when New York would close a gay bar as soon as it opened. In that pre-internet era, bars were the main places where gays met each other. So that And the piece really imagined what four artists who died from AIDS at that time might be like today, not just with words, but literally with photographs of what the artists might look like today. What were you getting at?
One of the things that I always think about, because these are artists I grew up admiring, you know, I'm 43, and so I was a child during these years, but old enough to sort of begin having an aesthetic vocabulary. And one of the things that we think about a lot is how AIDS didn't just deprive us of millions of lives, it deprived us of thousands of potential masterpieces. And if these people had lived, and because AIDS cut such a swath through the creative communities, what might they have produced? You know, Fran Lebowitz famously said, and I think Ed quotes her in his piece, that AIDS didn't just wipe out the people who created culture, it also wiped out the people who bought and consumed culture. And so in resurrecting these people through photographs, we wanted to pay tribute to what they might have been and what they might have kept contributing to the culture had this disease not come along.
Another thing in the T magazine is that a big cultural component of this time was the birth of hip hop.
Yes, yes. And it was really, as Nelson George writes in his essay, The Great Hip Hop Critic and Historian, it's when hip hop took over the world. It's when hip hop came downtown and white people started adapting it. You know, he talks specifically about Deborah Harry's performance on Saturday Night Live in 1981, and when it became mainstream. And, you know, hip hop had existed in early and nascent forms in the Bronx and in Harlem, but it really started infiltrating the culture at large in these years. You had tremendously influential radio shows. You had people making mixtapes. You had this idea that it wasn't just a music, but it was a lifestyle and a culture unto itself. And, you know, that also ties back into one of the reasons that this era was so influential. You were about 10 years out from, you know, three of the great civil rights struggles of the age, you know, from the struggle of civil rights, gay rights, and women's rights. And you had all three of those factors really motivating the birth of new culture.
Hanya Yanagihara, writer and editor of T, the New York Times style magazine. Did you read T this weekend, folks, on the pivotal years for New York City art, music, theater, film, fashion, food, 1981 to 1983? And we can invite just a couple of calls. Don't talk about the politics of 1981 to 83, if you remember those. This is not the sort of Reagan recollection. This is New York City culture, 1981 to 1983, which Hanya and the other writers posit were a real hinge time, as she put it, a pivotal turning point in art, music, theater, film, fashion, and food in New York City. Who remembers anything about that you want to share? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And just to stay on Nelson George for a minute, one of the contributors, he writes, "The funky 4 plus 1s, 1980, that's the joint, is a great example of how hip-hop's particular vernacular helped propel the culture forward. Let's take a listen to about 20 seconds of that.
Ooh, that's the joint.
What these words be said, we want y'all to hear.
We're gonna make a lot of sense.
We're gonna make it clear.
We're
gonna rock this place.
We're gonna
do some class.
We're
gonna do our best.
We're gonna make it last.
We got rhymes on the mind.
We got rocking in the heart.
And now the things we do, you can call it ours.
We're bad.
We're slick.
We're doing it here.
We're gonna rock this record.
And don't you forget.
Such an early hip-hop sound.
It's so great. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, Nelson talks about in the piece and that we wanted to recognize is that it fundamentally changed language. I mean, just listening to that 20-second clip, you hear about five or six words that have made themselves, you know, introduced themselves into the common vernacular that didn't exist before hip-hop. And if you think of how we talk today, so much of that was born from hip-hop.
By the way, I think I undersold your title. You're editor-in-chief of T, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so now everybody knows. The most prominent trend from New York Fashion Week this year was 80s-inspired fashion, mainly oversized silhouettes, blazers on both men and women, and shoulder pads.
Right.
How could we forget if we lived through it? Now, back then, those trends mirrored the rise of women entering the professional workforce. What do you think it means that these trends are coming back?
Well, they're like armor. I mean, when you have a suit for a woman with the big shoulder pads, I mean, it's both a way of degendering yourself and desexualizing yourself. And this was an era when women were beginning to enter Wall Street, for example, or corporate law firms in larger numbers. And nowadays, you know, you can't help but think of it as a similar response, as a way to avoid the conflation of sex and power in the workplace.
And for the issue, Nancy Haas writes, Uptown was shorthand for the well-lit East Side corridor where Nouvelle Society, powered by the Wall Street boom, resided in splendor. Downtown was the shadowy province beneath 14th Street, a countercultural warren of tenement walk-ups and industrial loft spaces. Is part of the story Uptown comes downtown or downtown infiltrates Uptown?
It was that they were such separate worlds. I mean, now I think more than ever, if you lived Uptown, and she's talking about the very narrow corridor of, you know, Fifth to Park, let's say, you really had no, perhaps going downtown was like a safari for you. It was a completely different world. And the two of the great books about New York City during the late 80s, you know, were Bonfire of the Vanities and American Psycho. And both of those represented two poles of New York that perhaps would never cross. Or if they did, it would be very awkward circumstances. And it, aesthetically, this was true, too. If you lived downtown in a grimy loft, it was far, far away from, you know, an Angela Donghia-inspired palace uptown.
Let's get a couple of reminiscences in here. Bruce on the East Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce. Welcome to your guest.
You're Bruce, and I welcomed you. But go ahead.
I was 20 years old in 81 and going to school downtown. And I remember that the Wall Street industry was not as suspect as they are today at all. They were kind of off, not on the radar as, malicious or phantom. But the rest of the city, I mean, the Bronx was burnt down. And in the Village and Times Square, there was a real palpable tone of subtle menace. I mean, it was provocative, I mean.
And I'm going to leave it there, Bruce, for time, because you put a good few thoughts on the table already, and I want to get at least one more caller in. But, Hanya?
But I think, Bruce, you're completely right. I mean, many of the people that we interviewed for this issue talked about how dangerous the city was, that the East Village was somewhere that you saw burning trash cans and people huddled around it for warmth, that it really did feel like a war zone. And at the same time, you had parties and you had clubs and you had great celebration just inches away, just blocks away. And you're right, it was before Wall Street really became the Wall Street we know today, and the divisions between the rich and the poor deepened and deepened during this era.
Carolyn in Sussex County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Yeah, I was married to an artist, a painter at that time, who came out of the abstract expressionist era. And one of the things that I noticed in that time was the incredible injection of money into the arts, the money and fashion. And it was just the beginning of a powerful art world. No longer was it just a question of art lovers collecting art, some of whom, of course, have always been extremely wealthy. But there was almost became a corporate culture as opposed to just the flourishing of the arts.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, art now is an industry, and it wasn't back in the early 80s. And in one of our stories, we have about the East Village artists of that era. We have Jeff Koons and some of his fellow East Village denizens talking about what it was like at that time. And it's, you know, this wasn't that long ago. And yet, you know, Jeff Koons, who was, of course, one of the wealthiest and most celebrated artists of our age, was showing in, you know, crappy little storefronts and probably eating burritos to stay alive. It was in the art world, got in a way priced itself out of its realm due to its own success.
One of the articles in our last few seconds is titled "What New York Was Like in the Early 80s, Hour by Hour." Ha! What do you do in that?
Well, this was our, I love oral histories. And so we just wanted to have as many voices as possible, everyone from Diane von Furstenberg and Al Sharpton to John Kelly, the performance artist, and Dapper Dan, the stylist in Harlem. And we had them go, we asked them, what was a representative hour like for you during those years and what were you doing? And many of these people, Samuel L. Jackson and his wife, LaTanya Richardson Jackson, were just starting out. And so their memories are also of being young and about the possibilities of being young too.
And there we leave it with Hanya Yanagihara, editor-in-chief of T, the New York Times Style Magazine. Thanks so much for coming on today. Really fun issue.
Thanks, Brian.
Looking back 1981 to 1983 as a cultural hinge, a culturally pivotal time for theater, music, art, fashion, other things in New York City. Because or despite Billy Joel's Uptown Girl.